Once again, the state of the economy is at the center of a presidential campaign, especially the current recession's impact on middle-class Americans. In his latest book, Who Stole the American Dream?, Hedrick Smith explores the events and legislation that allowed for the creation of our troubled new economy, and he says sparked the demise of the American dream. It's published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it brings Pulitzer Prize winner Hedrick Smith back to our show today. Hello.
Leonard, it's just great to be back with you, and particularly in these new digs. I used to see you in that old building, and it's just wonderful to see these great new studios.
Well, in the past, we've mostly talked about documentaries that you've been involved with, right. Although you have written books in the past. What brings you back to writing a book?
Well, what happened was I've done a bunch of documentaries. I did one on healthcare. I did one on retirement. I got very interested in the housing crash. This is now 3 years ago. And I said to David Fanning, who was the executive producer at Frontline, I'd like to do one on the subprime crisis. He'd wanted me to do it earlier, and I didn't have time. I was doing something else. And he said, it's all over. Let's forget the subprime crisis. And I said, well,
Is it really over?
No, of course not. He was wrong. But I said, let me do some research. And I came back about a month later. I said, David, this is so much bigger than you think it is. It's not a subprime crisis. It's actually a prime crisis. Most of the victims of subprime loans were prime borrowers. They should have gotten good loans. And the upside-down mortgage and the loss to of home equity, it's huge. It's going to be a drag on the economy for years. He said, no, I don't think we'll do a documentary. So I said, okay. I'll do a book. I'll put it together with some of the other stuff and begin. And what I saw in the housing thing was a paradigm. What happened in the housing crisis was similar to what happened with offshoring of jobs and a number of other things.
But you say that this is something that's been going on for a long time now.
Yeah.
We tend to think of it as something that happened within the last 15 years.
Yeah, I think that's one of the problems. I don't think we're going to get to a smart fix in this country if we don't understand really what the nature of the problems are that are troubling us and what the roots of them are. And I'm a little embarrassed because I covered a lot of this stuff for 30 or 40 years. And I have to tell you, when I started to scratch at it and go back and dig into it and do the reporting myself, what I discovered was there were a lot of things that I should have known that I didn't know. I mean, for example, I didn't know anything about the famous Lewis Powell memo. I thought of Lewis Powell as a Supreme Court justice who sat for 17 or 18 years appointed by Nixon. Well, maybe the most important thing that Lewis—
And a kind of a liberal Republican.
Well— moderate, let's put it this way. I wouldn't say liberal. He was a Virginia aristocrat, Tidewater drawl. He didn't favor massive resistance, even though he's from Virginia and a Southerner. But certainly, I didn't think of him as an ideologue, and I didn't think of him as a political activist. And it turns out he was a political Paul Revere. I didn't even know that. Right under my nose when I was working for the New York Times in Washington, he writes this memo back in 1971, and it starts a political rebellion by corporate America, which changed the landscape of power in Washington and is with us today. I mean, what we see today is really what we could call Powell's army. It's called the Gang of Six in Washington lingo, but it's how this started. I didn't know that. I shouldn't say that as a reporter, but that's part of the fun of doing a book as opposed to doing history on the fly as a reporter.
And what did he suggest in that memo, and do you feel he should have recused himself when he was hearing cases like First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti?
Well, what he said in that memo was that American free enterprise as a system was under assault from consumer advocates like Ralph Nader, from the AFL-CIO. He didn't say from the regulatory policies of Richard Nixon, the Republican president who was about to appoint me to the Supreme Court. But ironically, a lot of Powell's anger was directed at the regulatory policies of Republican Richard Nixon, not of Democrat Lyndon Johnson, who preceded him. It's just one of those delicious sort of ironies of history that you discover when you go back and scratch beneath the surface.
Because Richard Nixon signed the Clean Air Act and
Environmental Protection Agency, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, Mine Safety Board. There are dozens of boards that Nixon created and commissions that regulate, and Nixon saw it as his job to be a regulator of business. And Nixon himself regarded himself as a friend of the captains of industry, as a fan of free enterprise, as somebody who had depended on the political support of corporate CEOs. And when he sat down in the Oval Office with them, he talked the game privately to them, and he denounced Nader, and he denounced public opinion, and he denounced the environmental movement. But in public, as Bill Ruckelshaus, his first EPA administrator, told me, he didn't care about the environment. He didn't even understand the environment, but he knew the politics, and he was afraid he was going to have to run against Ed Muskie of Maine in 1972, and Muskie was a big environmental advocate, so Nixon got on the bandwagon.
And Tom Wicker once called him the last liberal president, which was interesting because of so many of these things, the bills that he signed.
I can tell you, going back and looking at Nixon's record, now you have to understand, Nixon wiretapped my phone. Okay, so I'm not a fan of Richard Nixon.
Were you on the enemies list?
I was on the enemies list. I was one of the 22 enemies, absolutely. Richard Nixon, compared to today's Democrats, he is to the left, was to the left of Clinton and Obama by far. Richard Nixon proposed a health care reform that makes Obama's health care reform look pale by comparison. I mean, people don't realize what's happened to the Republican Party over the last 30 years, or for that matter, what's happened to the Democratic Party.
Let's talk about, since we were talking about Lewis Powell, a decision that he wrote, the one that I referred to in 1978, the case of First National Bank of Boston versus Bellotti. It came in favor of the bank protecting the First Amendment right of a corporation to financially back a political process. We're still seeing the results of that today, aren't
we? No question.
Right?
No,
it's, but,
no,
it's mean, Citizens, Citizens United. United.
Absolutely. Well, that actually comes out of a Supreme Court decision that was made back in the 1880s, which decided that corporations were persons, and they were therefore covered by the Bill of Rights, freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and so forth. But Powell was certainly very important in enshrining that. And in his memo, he said business has got to be aggressive. It's got to be tough in politics. It's got to punish its enemies. It's got to organize. And literally, I could not believe it. This literally happened on my watch when I was Washington bureau chief of the New York Times. The number of business lobbying offices in Washington in one decade went from 175 to 2,225. The membership in the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which is the organization of small businesses, went from, listen to this, 3,000 to 600,000. The National Association of Manufacturers moved its headquarters to Washington. The Business Roundtable, which is the voice of the big big companies in America, 180 of the most powerful CEOs in America. It was formed in 1971, right after the Powell memo.
And you say all of this has led to a new economy, but there's always been a relationship between the politicians and business, hasn't
there?
Yes,
there has. But one of the things you have to watch in American history is the ebb and flow. If you look at American history, it's not consistent. What we have today is not what we had 30 or 40 years ago. You had three great waves of private wealth and three great waves of concentration of political power with business. One in the 1880s during the railroad era, the robber barons and so forth, along with a great long depression. The Roaring Twenties, which led eventually to Black Friday, the stock market collapse and the depression, and now in the new Gilded Age. So it ebbs and flows. Our history isn't consistent. So you're right. It's not as if it's never happened before, but we went through 30 or 40 years of what economists call the Great Convergence, which means people's incomes were closer together. The share of the national income that went to corporations or went to the top 1% was much lower than today.
Well, that all began after World War II, end of World War II, when the economy was booming. But also the tax rates were quite different.
Tax rates were very high. Tax rates were very high. It's interesting.
Well, why did we have a boom if job creators were being taxed high?
Because that's a bum story. We're getting a bum story. If you have you had a high marginal tax rate under Eisenhower of 92% and under Kennedy of 77% and under George Bush it was 35%, and the growth under Eisenhower and Kennedy was much more than under Bush. In fact, Bush's was the worst growth period of the last 60 or 70 years, even before the recession. So it's not the tax raise. What you discover, and I kind of bought this idea. You got to have low tax rates so the rich, because they save more of their money, the rest of us spend more of our money, so the rich have got to save the money. It's got to go to the banks. The banks have got to give it to companies. That generates growth. What generates growth, Henry Ford understood this better than almost anybody else, is consumer demand. If you pay your workers well, and they go spend their money, That creates massive demand, which forces companies to expand production, build new plants, buy new equipment, hire more workers, and you get the next round of growth. We've forgotten that's what causes growth, the virtuous circle of growth.
Now, you wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times about that. Right. Received a lot of flack yesterday in the letters pages.
Because they
felt that you were being too kind to Henry Ford, who was anti-union, who hired African Americans because he thought that they wouldn't join the union, they'd be grateful, was an anti-Semite. Should we really be holding him up as a model, a role model?
I'm not talking about Henry Ford as a role model. I'm talking about the insight that Henry Ford had and his idea. His idea was that if you pay workers well, and Henry Ford did that for competitive reasons. I mean, he was facing the drainage of jobs. He was facing people who were leaving there. Yes, Henry Ford was later on an anti-Semite, not so much at the period I was talking about, but yes, he was, and I would condemn him for that. But that isn't what I was talking about. I was talking about his economic ideas. But I have to tell you, if I got flack in the letters pages, the New York Times was sort of balancing it because I got a tremendous amount of mail that was enormously enthusiastic and people saying, thank God, somebody is remembering. There was a time where there were leaders of business capitalism, Robert Wood Johnson of Johnson & Johnson, the people who ran General Motors, people who ran Exxon, people who ran General Electric. Reg Jones, as the head of General Electric, was totally different from his successor, new economy successor, Jack Welch. One believed in the stakeholders. You got to support the employees as well as the shareholders and the customers. Because
they're the ones who buy your product.
Because they're the ones who buy your product. And you got to have them happy and stay with you, or they're not motivated to work well. It's a totally different idea now. The new economy practices what I call wedge economics. We can get into that if you want.
We will in a moment. Yeah. After we take a little break, my guest is Hedrick Smith, who's a best-selling author, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, Emmy Award-winning producer. His books, The Russians and The Power Game, were bestsellers. As a reporter for The New York Times, he shared a Pulitzer Prize for the Pentagon Papers series, won a Pulitzer for his international reporting from Russia in 1971 to 1974. His new book, Who Stole the American Dream, is published by Random House. When we come back, let's define the American dream and go on from there.
Be terrific.
And we're back with Hedrick Smith, whose latest work, I have to say latest work because he's been making documentaries for quite a while after you stopped writing books for a while. The latest one is called Who Stole the American Dream? It's published by Random House. So we have to go back and define the American dream,
sure,
which means different things to different people,
doesn't it? Of course
it
does. Well, to some people it means being the Horatio Alger story, starting from nowhere and going to the absolute top. But I think for a lot more people, and certainly during the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s in this country, where it got established kind of as a concept, it meant a solid job with fairly steady rising pay over your lifetime, so you were making more at the end than you did at the beginning, the opportunity to buy your own home, to have some kind of health care coverage to take care of you, and some kind of retirement, actually a lifetime pension. And believe it or not, Leonard, I'd forgotten, 84% of the workers for companies with more than 100 employees in 1980 had lifetime pensions, which meant they had guaranteed monthly paychecks for the rest of their life. So a secure retirement, health care, and then finally, the hope and belief that your children would live a better life than yours. Now, maybe that meant sending them to college or not, but at least it meant this notion of an escalator upward going on and security along with it.
So when did that start changing? It didn't start with the Lewis Powell memo, did it?
Well, it didn't start with the Lewis Powell memo, but the Lewis Powell memo, if there were two things that really affected it, and I want to get back to your question about when. If there are two things that really affected it, one was the power shift in Washington. The other was what I call wedge economics in the private economy. We can come back to that. But the change did really start in the late 1970s, and you can see it since then. And it is most striking
But that's when Jimmy Carter was president.
And that's the surprise. The surprise is politically that the watershed change that occurred in American politics occurred while the Democrats were in control of both houses of Congress and the White House. But it occurred because business had mobilized. I was talking about this before, the National Association of Manufacturers moving to Washington, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce building up its muscle, the business roundtable being formed. There were 50,000 people working for trade associations in Washington, business trade associations. There were 10,000 lobbyists. There were 9,000 corporate publicists. There were 130 lobbyists for every member of Congress by 1980. So the business army was there. That's why it happened under Carter.
Yeah, but you're also suggesting that that business had a negative impact on the economy. Was business shooting itself in the foot?
No, it didn't have a negative effect on the economy. This is very important, the issue we're about to talk about here. What we have tended to do when we've looked at how the economy was performing and how people feel is to take a look at what's happening to gross national product, that is the total national output. How are we doing? What's our national growth rate? 2%, 4%, whatever. And we sort of assume that it all gets cut evenly and everybody gets a share of it. And so if it's going up at 4%, everybody's doing well. That was true from 1943 to 1973. The productivity of the American workforce virtually doubled. It rose 97% in those 30 years, and the average hourly wage rose 95%. Almost dollar for dollar, hour for hour, even Steven. But from 1973 to 2011, which is the year for which we have the latest statistics, productivity went up 80%. And the average hourly wage went up 4%. And if you throw in benefits, the average hourly compensation went up 10%. 80% versus 10%. At the same time, the pay of a CEO in a major Fortune 500 company went from 40 times the average worker's pay in 1980 to 360 times in 2010.
So the CEOs are living out the American dream, but not the rest of us. As Joseph Stiglitz points out, the richest 1% of Americans own 40% of the nation's wealth.
You know, it's interesting. Stiglitz is known as a Keynesian economist. He's taken as a liberal. So lots of people say, well, you can't really trust Stiglitz. Well, what's interesting is that same figure was used by Citigroup in a slick investment brochure to its top investors who said, there's no point in investing in businesses that cater to the middle class, mass marketing. Advertising aides said, don't even bother with the upper middle class. 40% of the wealth in America is controlled by the top 1%. That's where you should put your investment. That's where you should put it. So this is, and Citigroup even said that the lopsided concentration of wealth in America is comparable to 16th century Spain and 17th century Holland. So this is something that economists on both sides agree upon. They don't like to talk about it sometimes during a political campaign, but the facts are out there. Yes, that's true.
Well, we often talk about that kind of income disparity when we talk about third world countries. Mexico, is that something like that happening in the United States?
It has happened. It has happened. We have the greatest constant. I heard an economist the other day say we have the greatest concentration of wealth in human history since the pharaohs of Egypt. It's unbelievable. The top 1% in this country in about 2010 made $1.35 trillion. That is more money to the top 1% in this country than the entire economy of Italy, than the entire economy of France, and then the entire economy of Canada. I mean, it's phenomenal, and they want more.
So what does this mean for the middle class? Because the middle class keeps on being cited by both parties during this campaign.
Well, I think we're now going to have to go back to politics. We haven't finished with wedge economics.
But okay,
you got the basic idea. The wedge economics basically cut the middle class out of its fair share of the gains of the economy. This is not sort of saying it should all go to the middle class. It's just simply saying if the economy is going to grow at 3 or 4% a year, if worker productivity is going to grow, then certainly money should go to people who invest in businesses. Certainly money should go to people who run businesses. But a fair share should go to the people who work in the businesses. That has not happened since 1978. The Census Bureau said the average hourly wage of a male worker last year was lower, adjusted for inflation, than in 1978. That's three decades of going nowhere. So that's the economics. And what's happened is, you know, in part, business has become powerful. labor unions have become weak, the public's become politically passive, and that takes us back to politics.
Now, what happens to the poor if this level of income inequality continues?
Well, what's going on is, and there's a big argument about what you should call the middle class. Some people say the standard of living of the middle class is lowering. It's going down.
But in America, a lot of people have called themselves middle class who would have called themselves working class in other countries.
And more people are starting to do that. There's a very interesting poll out by the Pew Center for the Media and I forget what it's called, Media and Public Policy. And more people are starting to identify themselves as lower class or working class. The number of people who identify themselves as middle class in America today is shrinking. Not a lot, but the fact that it's shrinking at all is important. Other people say either that you have middle class dropouts. New York Times for the last couple of years has been running a series of stories on what they call the new poor. These are middle-class dropouts. These are people who are $70,000 a year real estate agents, $80,000 a year computer programmers. I mean, we're not talking just about – everybody focuses on the assembly line and the factories in Ohio that close. And Matt Bai did a terrific job and terrific interview in the last half hour about that stuff. But it isn't just them. It's all kinds of people. It's back office people in banks. It's salespeople. A lot of people who were making very good pay back in the 1990s. And the early 2000s have been socked in there now down at half the pay they were making before.
My guest is Hedrick Smith, who has written a book called Who Stole the American Dream? It's published by Random House. Well, you mentioned that there's kind of voter complacency. Is that the word you used? There are 8 weeks until the election. How would you assess the political awareness of Americans in 2012?
You know, I was actually sitting down before I came here, Leonard, to write a piece for NPR. And it's really about anger. I gave a talk last night at a bookstore up here in New York, up at Barnes & Noble up on the Upper West Side. And the anger and the fear and the anxiety among the people there, 100 or 120 people there, was palpable. It was coming out. Fear about the country, anxiety that the problems are so much worse than are being addressed in the campaign, anger at both parties. There are people angry at Congress for a stalemate and not attending to the nation's problems. There are people angry at the banks for taking a bailout and then not helping folks on Main Street. There are people who are angry at Obama for not doing more. There are people angry at Romney for being so rich and not helping the middle class. I mean, it's all over the place.
But there's also anger from the right, the Tea Party.
Right.
And there's
sure.
anger from the left, the Occupy movement.
But
and yet people all seem to be suggesting that they feel powerless.
Yes, that is the key word. There's a great organizer in the southwest of America, a guy named Ernie Cortez, whom I've known for years. He organizes Hispanics particularly, but blacks and browns in Texas and Southern California and across the Sun Belt, southwestern Sun Belt. And he said something that was – it just blew me away. It was so profound. You know, this old saying of Lord Acton that power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Cortez has an amendment to that. He says powerlessness also corrupts. Powerlessness corrupts. It corrupts democracy at the core. We don't believe in ourselves. I mean, to me, one of the most striking things as a reporter who covered the civil rights movement in the 1960s, who saw the environmental movement explode with outrage at what was going on, the pollution in the American environment, 20 million people demonstrating on Earth Day in 1970, and a rush of legislation from Congress. I mean, it had an impact. And the civil rights movement had an impact. Ralph Nader, consumer movement had an impact. All kinds of safety regulations and then truth in labeling, that kind of stuff. The women's movement, the peace movement affected the end. We don't do that anymore. And I think we don't do it because we've become cynical about democracy. We don't sense our own power. People in the 60s and 70s believed that ordinary people could affect Washington, and they did.
But haven't politicians also been saying that all the things that you're saying were good have had a negative effect on the economy? They killed jobs. Then there are people who believe that the idea of climate change is really just some kind of a conspiracy and that it will have a negative effect on the economy. Part of it is who's giving you the message, isn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah, sure. People are confused. But Leonard, I would say people were always confused. What we've forgotten is during the civil rights period, There were people in Birmingham and in Raleigh-Durham and in Nashville and said, it's going to ruin business if we desegregate. People have forgotten. There were a lot of counter-arguments being made then, exactly the same kind of thing. And these popular movements said, no, we're going to move ahead because this is just, this is the right thing to do, and it'll help America.
Now, you mentioned earlier that many Americans at an earlier time had full retirement for the rest of their lives. What's happened to retirement since?
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable what's happened. The 401k plan came in, and the truth of the matter is it was an accident. It was actually put into the legislative hopper by Barbara Conable, who is an upstate New York Republican congressman. Good congressman. I knew him, liked him well. And he did it as a favor for Kodak and Xerox. He tossed it into the hopper.
Both of those companies barely exist today.
Yeah. so much for helping out those their executives. This is a tax shelter for executives for those companies. So some smart financial consultants went and said to the Reagan Treasury Department, it got passed in 78, by the way, under Jimmy Carter and the Democrats, okay? These guys go to the Reagan Treasury Administration in 1981 and say, why don't we do this for rank-and-file workers? So the Reagan people agree. And the mutual fund industry sees a bonanza, will market the 401k plan as power to the people. People have done terribly. Their balances in 401ks are terribly low.
So should we declare the American dream dead?
Well, we can declare the American dream is in the intensive care unit, which
can be revived.
It can be revived. I believe it can. But I'm one of those crazy people who believes it can only be revived if ordinary Americans decide to go in the streets. It can't just be kids in Occupy. It's got to be the kinds of people who marched in the environmental movement who got to go say this is intolerable. We can't have people's homes being foreclosed. People have their homes underwater. The banks get bailed out. But Main Street people don't get bailed out. I mean, what's fair about that?
But the country is seems to be totally divided these days. The polls indicate that there are hard and fast opinions that really can't be changed. It's pretty much 50-50.
Do you think the country wasn't divided on the issue of race in the 1960s? Do we imagine this is the only time America's been divided? That's nonsense. History clearly does. We are using this, in a way, as ordinary people, as an excuse not to take action ourselves. I mean, this has been the history of America. Every time we've had really difficult problems, we've been quite sharply divided.
Hedrick Smith, his latest book, a follow-up to The Russians and the Power Game, both bestsellers, is Who Stole the American Dream? It is published by Random House. And I thank you so much for being on our show again. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Leonard, I love being here. Like Matt, I love the show, and I love just talking with you and having the chance to just jaw about these very, very important issues.